Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, professional mountain climber and guide Dave Hahn has summited Mount Everest 15 times, more than any non-Sherpa climber. He has a foothold in the Northwest as well, having summited Mount Rainier over 270 times. KUOW environment reporter Ashley Ahern wanted to learn more about Hahn's life, how mountaineering has changed over the years, and what motivates him to keep climbing. Dave Hahn spoke with Ashley Ahern at the Eddie Bauer Store in University Village on October 28th. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording.
Hello, everyone. First of all, thank you so much for coming out, and thank you for being a supporter of KUOW. I love my job, and I love that I work at a place where I meet people all the time who are my bosses. You're technically my bosses. You pay the bills. And when we say that on the Air for Pledge Drive, I sincerely mean that, and there are so many other models of journalism out there that I could have pursued, and this was the one that I wanted to do. And the other thing I will say about KUOW is it's not every day that you have a member station that has its own reporter devoted to the environment. That is a rare thing. And I feel very lucky to have that job, and I feel very lucky to live in a place with so many people who are thinking about this stuff and are going to spend a Friday night hanging out and hearing really cool stuff from a guy who knows more about the wild and wonderful corners of the earth than I probably ever will, that's for sure. So thank you for coming out tonight. I want to take a few minutes before we get to the main event to talk about a project I'm really excited about at KUOW. We are going to be launching a national podcast on the environment. It's time, right? Like, how is there not a podcast on the environment? I'm kind of looking around at my podcast feed and wondering, what gives? You know, why isn't anybody doing this? Why isn't anybody out there, you know, doing the kind of on-the-ground radio reporting I'm doing every day, but bringing it to a national audience, asking these bigger picture questions? And so it's going to be called, we haven't launched yet, so this is not, like, totally public, but Terrestrial is the name of the podcast, Exploring the Choices We Make in a World We Have Changed. I'll say that again. Terrestrial, Exploring the Choices We Make in a World We Have Changed. Or as I like to tell friends, it's the We're Effed, Now What? Podcast. Because climate change is happening, and we're already seeing the effects, and now we have to figure out, how do we live on this planet? How do we enjoy our everyday lives? How do we make decisions about the food we eat, what we do with our bodies when we die? What kind of cars do we drive? Do we have kids, given what the planet's going to look like in the coming decades, 100 years or so? These are questions that my generation, we're not responsible for where we are right now, but we are the first generation that's going to have to figure out what the hell to do about it. So it's an exciting time to be working in public radio as we start thinking about new ways to reach younger listeners. And it's a really exciting time and a scary time to be covering the environment. How many of you have heard of the term the Anthropocene? So all the leading geologists in the world got together at a conference not too long ago and officially accepted the fact that we are now in a new geologic age where human beings have fundamentally altered the planet, and we are the main, I shouldn't say cancer, but like deciding factor in the planet's future. And so, you know, living with that, when you kind of stop to think about that, we live in really crazy times. So great time to be covering the environment, great time to be exploring the environment. And for all of you out here tonight, I'm sure you share certain interests that we will be covering on the podcast. We are going to be looking for fundraising specifically for this podcast. If you know of folks with deep pockets who want to give, pay it forward, get more people thinking about these questions, please get in touch with the KUOW Development Department. They are wonderful people, as you can tell from meeting Shalan. And now, without wasting any more time, I am really, really excited to have Dave Hahn here tonight. But first I want to do a quick survey. Outdoorsy people, I'm guessing if you're out on a Friday night hanging out at Eddie Bauer, chances are you've got some inclinations towards the outdoors. So we're going to start. Raise your hand. This is like a sliding scale. You are so outdoorsy that you have a nice rain jacket. You live in Seattle. I figured that's a given, right? Okay. That was one thing I learned here. Don't carry umbrellas. That's totally not legit. And don't buy designer jackets. Buy a designer rain jacket. That's when you know you're like fitting in. All right. You are so outdoorsy, you walk the dog in the rain. Yeah. My dog needs a poncho. You are so outdoorsy, you bought a nice pair of boots, but maybe haven't broken them in yet. Moving up the ladder here. Yeah. Maybe haven't broken them in. You're so outdoorsy, you do a couple miles on the weekend in the mountains. Okay. You are so outdoorsy that you live for your next multi-day backpacking trip and you do at least one a summer. Okay, cool. Yeah, this is a good crowd tonight. You are so outdoorsy that you have summited one of the big mountains around here. I'm not talking about Mount Si. Okay. All right. How many have summited Rainier? How many times? Okay. So this guy, 275 plus times. Right? So we are very excited to have Dave Hahn here to talk to us about his adventures. He has also summited Everest 15 times. We're going to talk tonight about the times where he didn't make it all the way to the top and the adventures he's had along the way and the people he's met, and also about conservation. How do outdoors people be better conservationists? And what does conservation look like in this day and age with adventurers and mountaineers and people who are kind of sponsored athletes changing the way they brand themselves and market themselves? I call it kind of the GoPro generation of mountaineers. So Dave, come on up, join me, let's chat. And I should add, I'm really excited to have you guys ask a bunch of questions at the end. We're gonna give plenty of time, like 20 minutes for the audience to jump in. So be thinking about what you wanna ask, Dave. I don't have all the questions. Yes. So Dave lives in Taos, New Mexico. He is a sponsored Eddie Bauer athlete. Thank you to Eddie Bauer for bringing him here to have this wonderful evening with us and KOW. And he gets to travel all over the world and climb things that most of us kind of look at in pictures and then think that'd be really nice to do someday and then move on with our Facebook feed. All right, so I got to ask first off, 275 times up Rainier. Do you kind of notice when rocks get moved?
yeah, except after that many times and that many times up high on Everest, I can't remember, you know, where the rocks were supposed to be. It's different every time. It's a new challenge every time. That's what keeps it interesting for me. And it's important to distinguish, you know, the reason that I've climbed it so many times is I'm much more of a mountaineering guide than I am a climber. You know, a climber would get well and truly bored with doing the same mountain over and over, doing the same route over and over. But of course, guiding is a whole different set of challenges, and that's new every time and terrifies me every time, and it keeps it properly interesting.
So. Tell me about the first time you tried to climb Everest.
So 1991 was my first time to the Himalaya. And yeah, to preface it, I had already been to Denali seven times by then, had been leading trips on Denali. So it wasn't like I won a trip to Mount Everest in 1991. You know, that was kind of the start. The first commercial trips on Everest, guided trips, organized expeditions were just starting around then, but ours wasn't. It was one of the last of the old school type trips where we like sold t-shirts and stuff like that. And that was great, but we also found some rich guys. But it was, as I said, I didn't end up on Everest by accident. It had been a huge goal of mine, and to get there in 91, we went to the north side, the Tibet side, which still wasn't all that common in 91. And up on the North Ridge, which was the original route that the British had tried in the 1920s. And it was a fascinating trip for me. It was also, you know, I got my heart and soul into that trip and got crushed in so many ways. Turned around about 1,000 feet short of the summit. I was trying it without oxygen. That's the only time I've tried it without oxygen. And I don't remember it being all that nice a day when we turned around at 28,000 feet. But of course, I can't, you know, it's only 1,000 feet left, but I can't say that, if it had been a nicer day, I would have sailed to the top. Because with Everest, that last 1,000 feet, that's the 1,000 feet that makes all the difference, as particularly when you're trying it without oxygen. So I don't know how it would have turned out, but in retrospect, I'm happy it turned out. I'm okay with having turned around. I was crushed at the time, but I also was dead certain that I was going to be back there. It meant enough to me. It moved me in enough ways that I was going to fight to get back there one way or the other.
How many tries did you make before you summited?
So I summited Everest on my second try in 1994. By then I had been to the Himalaya again, to Shishapangma in 1993, and had continued to guide Denali and Rainier. The 94 trip was, again, Everest is a 2.5 month expedition, and that 94 trip as well was a Tibet north side trip, and pretty profound experience. Not so much because I summited, but it ended up that I summited alone in a snowstorm, ran out of daylight, ran out of oxygen, ran out of brains, and somehow made it through the night. But it was kind of a 60-hour nonstop climbing extravaganza. And it was, when I had survived it all, when I had got back down and I was safe and my fingers and toes were all right, it was almost a footnote that I had been to the summit in the process. I realized immediately that it would have been the same experience if I'd turned around 100 feet short or 200 feet short. But I quickly forgot that and started bragging about it.
Everest, when we hear about Everest in the news now, it's about kind of too many people trying to climb it and the pollution and kind of violence that's happened there in recent years. Can you tell us how the mountain has changed since 1991, 94, when you were there?
Sure. It, like so many of the, what we used to call the odd things that we do, it's gone mainstream. Just like the Boy Scouts can't have a soapbox derby anymore without, it being like professionally sponsored and everything. Yeah, Everest is a big deal, and partly it's my fault. I came along at the perfect time for making it my career. Guiding 8,000 meter peaks, the job didn't exist before I started going over there. So in a sense, I've been promoting it. I've been telling stories about it. I've been showing pictures. I've been bragging about it. And, that it's caught on. And a couple of years ago, I probably would have been like defensive about Everest, saying, the crowding's not that bad. It's just the angle that they took that picture at. There's ways to avoid it. And, my impression in recent years, it is too crowded. And it's a real problem if you're a climbing guide expedition leader, which means you're a control freak. And the crowd, in a large sense, means that you lose some control. And whether you lose enough control for you to feel like you can't do it safely, I think that's a real concern. It is important to describe exactly what the problem is, though. That everybody goes in the spring season, the popular time for trying to get up Everest. You're usually getting there at the end of March, beginning of April. You're getting your body in shape, you're getting the route built, you're establishing your higher camps, you're getting acclimatized, and trying for a shot at the summit sometime in mid-May. And that's the trouble, is that everybody's going for that little spot, and they're doing it on the established routes from the north side and the south side. If you went any other route, it's not crowded. If you went any other season, like, say, the monsoon season or the winter or even the fall, it's not crowded, but it's a lot harder, and there's more chance of dying. And so you can understand why, you know, the game has transformed from the years of exploratory climbing on Everest, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s, to the summit is everything now. And so if the summit is everything, you can't blame people for going when the chance is absolutely best for getting to the top. It costs a lot, and it's a huge commitment. So people want that best shot at the top. But as I say, the game has changed to bring it to that point.
That is a perfect segue into what I really wanted to ask you about, which was how have professional athletes or mountaineers, professional adventurers, changed in the years that you've been doing this as a career? When you look at kind of the young up-and-comers, what's different about them?
Well, I mean, in some ways, you can look back in history and read about old climbers that had the same illnesses that we do, you know, and Antarctic explorers like Shackleton, who had the self-promotion bug the same way we do now when we're looking for sponsorship or approval. So, you know, I don't know that people have changed, but certainly the number of people doing this kind of thing, as I say, it's gone somewhat mainstream. You know, that climbers used to be a little bit quirky, you know, a little off, a little weird. Sorry.
But, seems like they still are, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me gently. They still are. But yeah, these days, yeah, there's that whole cool aspect to it that, you know, that you can monetize success in climbing and mountaineering just like you can in anything else, and that, you know, turning it into a business certainly changes the character of things. But, you know, you can say that, but of course you still meet wonderful people climbing. You still, you know, because somebody turns out to be, you know, a very accomplished climber or a highly skilled or a really strong climber or well-hyped climber, doesn't mean that they're not also pretty cool people. You know, I think of Alex Lowe, who died in 1999. I still think of Alex all the time. I mean, he was just the most incredible climber, you know, as far as pushing the standards and capable in so many ways. But what blew me away about him back then, what still makes me, you know, cherish the memory of him, was he was such a neat guy when you got to know him, that, you know, I was just blown away that this could coexist, that kind of personality, that kind of intelligence with that much skill and accomplishment.
I'm sure it's a spectrum, and it's not to generalize that all new young climbers are all about GoPro and self-promotion and Facebook, but one thing that you've said that kind of struck me was treating the outdoors as your gymnasium as opposed to your temple. Tell me about that. What did you mean by that? And can your gymnasium be a gateway to something else?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we are in danger of that. You know, there is that you come from the rock climbing gym and you take it to the great outdoors, and you could miss that the great outdoors happens to be a national park, you know, where you're going to play these games, or happens to just plain old be beautiful country, great mountains. It is required when there's this many of us playing these games. It's pretty different from in the formative days of these things where you could go into these weird places and you were going to be the only ones going there, and you could assure yourself that it was, you know, as people did, that this was never going to be a thing, you know, so you could leave whatever mess you wanted, and, you know, it wasn't, that wasn't bad. Obviously, you can't do that now. There's too many of us doing it, so you have to go into these places more responsibly, and people coming up in the sports, they might not always know, they might not always have the perspective to know what kind of damage they can have on an environment. And certainly when you've been in these places for a little bit longer, you have that appreciation and that fear of losing these pristine places. So I don't say that the up and coming climber or skier is necessarily evil, but sometimes, just like all of us, they have to learn to value this not just as a playground, but as sacred ground to so many of us.
You you bring a lot of very wealthy, powerful people into these pristine places. Why and what do you hope to accomplish? How do you see that as, I don't know, helping conservation, helping protect these places?
That makes me sound really altruistic. when of course the reality is that, you know, I was trying to figure out how to make a living doing the things that I wanted to do in the places that I wanted to. But sure, as you get successful, invariably, yeah, some of your clientele are going to be wealthy, powerful. And, you know, it's not, I can't take credit for this argument. It's been made many times, but I do believe it to be true that to get protections for these wild places, people of power and influence need to know about these wild places. If they don't, then it's just a good place to get coal or timber, you know. And so I do think there's real value, but I don't think it's, you know, if you go too far in that direction, it's only bring the rich people into the mountains. And I think there's a lot of value in bringing normal people into the mountains.
You know? I didn't mean to imply that you only bring rich people. But what I was getting at is that this kind of extreme activity is very expensive. And I think it kind of makes me think about, you know, when we think about conservation in the West, I think the tendency in urban kind of wealthier outdoorsy circles is that, you know, you want to put the pretty places in a box and keep them safe from whomever's going to harm them. And the truth is that it looks really different on the ground. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about Nepal and Everest in that context.
Oh, you bet. I mean, I think we do need to guard against elitism, and yeah, maybe I'm a poor one to talk about it, since some of the trips that I guide cost tens of thousands of dollars. You know, yeah, that's elitism. But you know, there are still two ways to get on these trips. There's going through the front door, and there's the way that I go on these trips, you know, working on them. And those doors are still open. When you take it over to a place like Nepal, it gets complicated in a hurry because, yeah, the kind of people that can afford, let's say Everest starts for Americans on a well-guided, well-planned trip starts at about $60,000-$65,000 when you include permitting and logistics and guiding. And you're going to be on a trip like that, you're going to be around some desperately poor people by our standards, and a completely different model for an economy in Nepal. And yeah, there are some amazing contrasts, and it can lead to uncomfortable situations. It can lead to accusations of exploitation, which has happened in recent years, that you're asking people who badly need the money to take serious risks. And in some cases, yeah, the flaw is people asking somebody to take a risk that they themselves aren't willing to take. And those folks can't necessarily turn that down because the economic pressures are so great. So that, in a nutshell, is one of the bigger problems that way. But I don't think it has to be. I think there are responsible ways of being in these environments and these disparate economies, and there are irresponsible ways.
Yeah, and I think the temptation to sort of say, well, they're polluting Everest, all these, hundreds and hundreds of hikers are destroying the mountain, shut it down, and that kind of ignores the very real economics of the pursuit of Everest and what that means for Nepalese.
Yeah, you bet. I didn't go to Everest this last year. It's the first time in 20 years that I didn't go. And I probably have priced myself out of the market. And I guess I'm not really willing to change that. The last few years there were quite difficult as an expedition leader. The avalanche that killed 16 Nepalis in the icefall a couple of years ago, and the earthquake last year, so 2015, that killed so many at base camp, injured so many, and killed so many Nepalis. Those were pretty tough years. I guess it's important that I preface this answer by saying that I didn't go there this year. One of the things that's always bothered me a little bit about some of that criticism of, oh, we should shut down Everest, is oftentimes it seems to come from climbers who aren't going there anymore but are worried that their accomplishment is going to take a beating from all the people that don't deserve to be there getting to the top of the mountain. So I don't quite feel that yet. But I think it's fundamentally wrong to sit here and say they should shut down Everest, because it misses the point that it's not a national park in Washington State, it's a national park in Nepal and Tibet, and the tourism industry that is dependent on it is that's a pretty callous thing to say, well, cut that off, stop that, because Everest is our temple. It's, these great things for mankind are represented by it. It's also, in real terms, it's putting food on the table for a lot of Nepalis. It's bringing in income in a place where income is really hard to come by, generating revenue. So, I would say, short of shutting it down, the next call is well regulated. And yeah, we can all see that it could use a little bit of regulation, but you know, the government of Nepal has so many profound problems that have to do with people living in cities and towns. It's maybe a little unrealistic to think that they're going to get it just right for figuring out climber numbers, especially when the government of Nepal is taking in 11,000 per U.S. per climber. That's hard to turn away from that. You know, they're desperately in need of revenue.
I do, in my line of work, you know, I do a lot of traveling around the state and these kinds of local or state-level conservation issues. There are some parallels between the people who live in these beautiful areas trying to make a living, oftentimes much poorer than the people who come to these areas to enjoy them, and the conflict that comes when people that live there want to make money off of those natural resources. So I wondered if you had any thoughts for the kind of urban outdoors people about how they can be better conservationists, but maybe also be helping with this kind of, I think, increasing rural-urban divide that we have in this country.
Oh, you bet. I mean, you know, again, mentioning that I am part of the problem, you know. But there are some basics. As I said earlier, when we could have an impact before because there were so few of us, I'm not just talking about climbers. I'm talking about river rafters, kayakers. Yeah, you know, 30 years ago, it didn't make much difference if you made a mess. It matters today. So as a basic, everybody's got to learn leave no trace principles. There shouldn't be any sign of you after you've been there. And if you can't be there, adhering to those principles, then don't go. You know, that's simple. You either find a way to lessen your impact or go somewhere else. And yeah, we do have to, it's our responsibility to educate the people around us. You know, not at the point of making somebody angry and violent, but especially people coming from an urban background, urban environments, may not have any idea of the impacts they're causing on a trail or carving their name in a tree or something. So, you know, we have to do what we can to participate in educating and spreading the word.
You brought Gary Johnson up Everest, and not to make this about politics, but did he know what country he was in?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to ask. Tell me about what that was like. What was he like to hike with?
Hey, he was a great partner. That was 2003 on Everest, and Gary had been the governor of New Mexico for the preceding 8 years. And that's the link. He actually lives down the street from me. I live in northern New Mexico and work as a ski patroller. And Gary, as an ex-governor, skis really hard. We got a great chess rivalry going in that 2003 Everest expedition. We were successful at climbing the mountain, incidentally, but I ended up owing Gary money at the end of the trip. It wasn't completely honest the way he did things, but so we still carry this rivalry on today, and I still play chess with him. Happy to say that I've recouped my losses, but we climbed together again two years ago. Gary climbed Vinson, the highest mountain in Antarctica, and that's one of my specialty mountains. I think Gary's a great guy. He's loads of fun. We had the good sense not to talk politics on those trips. You know, we wouldn't necessarily agree, but you know, those are rules that you're smart to adhere to anyway on a trip in the mountains. And you know, well, I think that's one of the always been one of the great things about our country, our society, is that you could have your agreements, disagreements politically, you should still be able to share a rope. You should be able to share an adventure. And I think it's pretty cool that the people that might be in power have some exposure to these high and beautiful and remote places. And, you know, I feel assured that that Gary values those places and those experiences.
Do you think you'll ever stop climbing, Dave? What does retirement look like? Should it ever come?
That's a good question. I'm sure I should be considering it, but I'll turn 55 this week, and I'm not.
Happy birthday!
Oh, thank you. I'm not actually ready to consider it. I'm still having too much fun with it. You know, when I work my summers out at Mount Rainier, my assistant guides are often now 30 years younger than me, smarter, better looking, stronger. It's really humbling if you're the humble type, but no, I still love what I'm doing, and it still feels good doing what I'm doing. I think retirement for me, probably for many of you, it's changed over the years. I'm never gonna quit working. For me, guiding and ski patrolling has become guiding, ski patrolling, writing, speaking, you know, showing pictures, slides, designing gear, and so I don't see ending that. I see, at a certain point, I'll have to give up some of the bigger, stupider mountains, but I don't think I'll ever give up skiing, climbing, walking. And, you know, I find I've really gotten into hiking in the last couple of years, and there were decades of my climbing career where I would have, you know, scoffed at hiking, backpacking, you know. And I absolutely love going hiking now. So I'm evolving backward again.
Okay, my last question. So have your questions ready. I just need that, like, pep talk for when you're going on a hike and it just gets really, really hard to keep going. And what do you think about when you're just at that point where you're like, oh, forget about it. I'm going home. It's raining. I'm done. This is too hard. I'm not going to be able to walk tomorrow, let alone right now. How do you keep, what are you telling yourself in your head when you're at that point?
There's a lot of shame involved. You don't let yourself go there. There's a discipline of, you know, thinking, you know, channeling your mind to what you can control and not over what you can't control. I guess the way people frame that often with me is, how can you stand the cold? You know, do you like the cold? Because I work each year in Antarctica, up in Alaska, Mount Rainier, when it's hot down here, it's pretty cold up there. And because I work in so many cold places for so many months, they think that I like the cold. And no, not necessarily, but I can keep in mind really well in a cold place. I'll be in Antarctica in 3 weeks. I can keep really well in mind while I'm down there how nice and comfortable it is back where I live, and that if I play my cards right, I could be comfortable the rest of my life if that were the goal. But increasingly, it's those times when you're desperately uncomfortable cold, tired, you know, thrashed within an inch of your life, yeah, you, turns out those are the, those end up being the valuable times, assuming that you come through it okay.
And with that, thank you, Dave Hahn, so much. It's time for questions. Shalane has the microphone.
I think, oh, the mic's working. Thanks, Rob. Okay, so I'm going to pass along the microphone. When you're done with your question, if you could just pass it back down the aisle to me so we can get to the next person. We're going to have some fun. Cedric. He's ready.
I'm ready. Was there ever a time, an event, or something that happened when you thought, this is done, I quit, no more of that, I this is too much?
About 7 days a week, 365 days. No, I mean, you know, there are long, hard trips where I will admit that I've come down a mountain muttering and gritting my teeth and, you know, mad at everybody. But that usually fades. And, you know, I mean, people ask, you know, have you had these close calls? Have you almost died out there? And yeah, I have, but I would kind of separate that into there's kind of, in for me, basically there's two kinds of things that might produce that, and the one is like the bolt of lightning, the rock charging down the hill just where you just walked or just in front of you. There's that kind of thing. And then there's the digging yourself into a hole and really overdoing it and having, you know, this gigantic set of challenges to get yourself out of this situation and get yourself back to safety and good times. And, you know, both of those kinds of experiences should have an effect on you and should make you either smarter or luckier next time. But yeah, that, I guess I would address what you're talking about that way, that that if something's really eating you up on a trip, then you find a way to change that situation or determine not to get into that fix again.
So if someone has $75,000 and ability to take 3 months off, what are their barriers to going with you up Everest? Can you predict their success rate, assuming they're reasonably healthy, so on and so forth? Who succeeds and who doesn't, and can you predict that?
I can predict that, and I'm wrong sometimes. I have bet against a few folks. Don't tell them. I have had that gut feeling that this person's, you know, this is going to be too difficult for them, and I've been wrong. But yeah, the important thing to set this up is that, yeah, we're not going to take that check up here at the cash register and go off to Everest next week. It's going to be a several-year process for somebody, and the more years it takes, oftentimes the better. The more you could call it training, but that sounds desperately boring. The experiences that you can put in those years leading up to Everest, you know, be it climbing in Alaska, climbing on Rainier, climbing in South America, the lead up to that Everest climb is going to be extremely important. And so, yeah, I'd say that overall, this patience is going to be what it's going to take, that they maybe don't realize. the patience to do that proper build up to where Everest isn't too big a reach when you go for it. And then on the mountain, that patience. To use Gary Johnson, since we were, you know, talking about him, and Gary is an incredible endurance athlete, and his 8 years in office, he kept right up at that, you know, kept winning races and, you know, running, riding bikes and stuff. And my concern going into the trip was kind of two things. One, would he have the patience for this? It's not a marathon. A marathon's there. 2 months living on Mount Everest, it's not who shows up there strongest and fastest. It's after that mountain has whittled you away for those 2 months, who goes away from there strong? So it's that different kind of event. I wondered how a focused athlete like him would have that kind of patience. And also, yeah, you worry about somebody who's always been in charge and, you know, used to calling the shots. And, yeah, is he open-minded enough that he's going to let some guide who doesn't know how to run the state or the country, you know, take over the leadership of a trip? And yeah, to my pleasant surprise, Gary was both on great on both counts. So,
how did you get your start? What age were you? Who led you, etc.?
My dad was a climber. My dad's still alive. He's 83. He broke his ankle hiking last month. And he felt so bad to tell me. He felt so guilty telling me that he was out hiking alone and he broke his ankle. He knows he shouldn't be hiking alone. He knows he shouldn't be hiking alone at 83. And, you know, I heard that and I was like, yeah, okay, so he must have caused a big rescue. It must have been a helicopter involved. Yeah, he's feeling guilty. Well, then when I got to talk to my dad, it turned out that, no, there wasn't. He walked out 2 miles on a broken ankle. And so, you know, I certainly had a good example. Well, you could call that a good example, but, but you know, I didn't invent mountaineering. My dad was a climber. He always had me out hiking, and said he started me out in the Pinnacles in California and that I carried my own diapers on my first backpacking trip. And I'll bet I cried good and loud. I don't remember liking it very much as a kid, but something stuck. Nah, I got my start at Mount Rainier in 1985. I came out to learn climbing. My dad had already been on Denali, and I wanted to go there with him. And he said I had to come to Mount Rainier to learn the ropes, so to speak. And when I saw the guide service on Rainier, you know, I'd been a year or two out of college at that point, didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I saw the guide service, and I was just absolutely blown away. I met these guys who were just a couple years older than me, who'd been all over the world, which wasn't that common in the mid-1980s to meet Americans that had been in Tibet. And, yeah, I suddenly knew exactly what I wanted to do. And in a lot of ways, I haven't looked back. You know, it's been a series of adding, you know, a few more jobs on top and a few more destinations, but I've held on to all these same mountains over the years, and I'm still caught up in it completely.
Thank you. Well, I have very different goals from you. Like, for me, getting to the top would be impossible, but I have a chance to go to the base camp and the south side, and this was already a lot of challenge and a lot of fun. And can you tell me if what going on the north side adds and what are the differences between the two sides, both from a people village point of view and not just from a strict, you know, mountaineering side, because in my situation it's both the cultural and the hiking, which is fun.
You bet. Well, my first 10 years of going to the Himalaya were mostly on the Tibetan side of things. And I guess I believed wrongly that that things were traveled out on the Nepal side. You know, Jimmy Carter had been up to base camp on the south side of Everest, and I thought, well, if Jimmy Carter's done it, then everybody's done it. But it turns out to be one of the great walks of the world still to walk into Everest Base Camp. It's not the same experience that Ed Hillary had when he first went there in like 51, 52, and their big climb in 53. It's changed considerably, but it's still a very valuable experience walking up the Khumbu Valley. The Tibet side, geographically, it's very different. It's the dry side of the mountains. So it's typical to drive to base camp on the north sides of the mountain because the Tibetan plateau comes right up to the mountains, whereas on the Nepal side, you're going from jungle and cornfields walking up to the mountains. It's a pretty different approach through Tibet. That said, we have contrived it a little bit to walk into base camp on the north side, but it's a very different experience that way. It's continually changing. Of course, it's the Tibet side is China, and that has been a difficulty in recent years that the Chinese have been pretty difficult to deal with as far as permitting and permitting travel in Tibet, because they frankly don't they want to control the story of what's going on in Tibet.
I'd be curious to hear some stories about your guiding. Obviously, you like it, taking amateurs, people of different and different backgrounds. Just some impressions about that, good, bad, in between. You must enjoy taking rookies up Mount Rainier.
I do. I mean, I think what stayed good for me about guiding is that I can so easily remember the fears that you have when it's your first time there, and the uncertainty. And you know, it turns out that the things you're so concerned with that first time up Mount Rainier, they're all the wrong things to be concerned about. That you know you should be concerned, but it's things you don't know about. But I definitely believe that it's that my ability to have some empathy for my folks is what has made a great difference for me over a lifelong career. But sometimes convincing people that I empathize is difficult, because as you get more of a reputation, they think your reputation is for like a Michael Phelps like feet of swimming or climbing. And it's like, well, no, for climbing I can point to Ed Veister's, if you want like the Superman, I'm just your average guy. And sometimes I have to disabuse people of this notion that I don't get tired or that I don't get cold. Or when I've told the novice climbers that, yeah, we're going to take a break about every hour or so, they'll be like, hey Dave, that's 59 minutes. And I'll be like, yeah, did you think I was going to forget? Did you did you think I'm not carrying a big pack? And, you know, so yeah, I guess one of the things that I find kind of interesting is when my clients just tell me, hey, this is hard. It's like, well, yeah, I know. I'm aware. Guess what? Welcome to hell.
When I was summoning Rainier, I also had like the guide. We have, it's been an hour now. So like we need to rest. So I get that. Last question. I know, it's time. How did we get here? Oh, we've got a tie. We'll come back to you, I promise. Okay.
So I work for a youth outdoor adventure program here in Seattle. What kind of charge would you give young people who are interested in getting in the outdoors or pursuing a career in the outdoor industry?
Ian, what's the program?
I work for a program called Cascade Leadership Challenge.
So when you say what kind of charge? What kind of?
Yeah, or what kind of advice or words of wisdom would you pass along to young people? So teenagers, young adults, college students.
Yeah, you know, I think the a difficult thing is getting people to young people to understand that life is long. You don't have to do it all this year. You don't have to do it all next year. You know, and I think that's a problem with a lot of youth sports. I mean, I wasn't any good at baseball and football and the conventional sports. I was terrible at it. And, the trouble, of course, is that being the case, your athletic life could be over at age 20 or 21. You're teaching as, you know, one of the coolest things about Seattle and Tacoma and, you know, these places within reach of the Cascades is that kids are learning activities that are going to last a lifetime for them, as long as they don't burn out on them or get carried away and make some mistake out there by going too fast. So I think it's the same challenge that we have for so many other aspects for teenagers and young people, is making them realize that they're just getting started, that if they play their cards right, they could have a pretty enjoyable life in the mountains, not just an enjoyable year or an enjoyable season.
Yeah, right. You're the last. Well,
that's pressure. Since I've learned we're approximately the same age, and you've touched a little bit on aging and your physical strength, how much has your stamina and physical strength changed over the last 25 years? And since we're the same age, what are you expecting in the next 25?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I had an interesting time in my late 30s. I was diagnosed with celiac disease, and so that was 1999. That wasn't that common a diagnosis then, and it totally made the difference for me. You know, I had a couple of years of decline leading into that, and all my friends, you know, my good friends who were, you know, looking for any way to twist the knife in me, they said, you're just getting old. And I didn't think that I was. I didn't think, that didn't seem right. But of course, that diagnosis and getting that solved, I was gluten intolerant. And getting that figured out gave me this, you know, this new hold on life. I would not have been able to continue as a high altitude mountain guide had that not been figured out. But I got stronger in my late 30s and going into my early 40s, and that, you know, that felt really great at a time when society says, oh yeah, you're in decline. It wasn't that way for me. And you know, but I expect to see, actual aging. I expect to feel some decline. I don't mean to fight it, but man, it's fun. It's fun while it lasts, and I don't want to quit too soon. You know, the great danger, of course, would be taking responsibility for guiding people on a big, stupid, committing mountain and then finding that I'm too old once I'm there. But I test myself all the time by my day-to-day work on Mount Rainier, my day-to-day work ski patrolling at high altitude. I'm very much looking for those signs of when I need to scale it back. And, you know, I promise I'll be ready for that when the time comes, but while I can enjoy it, I'm going to keep enjoying it. So let me just thank you for coming here. And this works out great for me working for Eddie Bauer. I'm also like, my radio has been set to KUOW when I'm in Washington for like the last 10 years. And so I just happen to be a great fan of the station, and thanks to you guys for knowing how to support it.
Yeah, round of applause for that. Thank you, Dave.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum, featuring Ashley Ahern's conversation with renowned mountain climber Dave Hahn. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.